Today's program was brought to you by Bordeaux Wines. Red, white, rosé, there's a reasonably priced wine for everyone and for every occasion. For more information, visit bordeaux.com/US.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and Alta Linea is officially closed for the season. Thank you so much for everyone who came, who drank our frozen Negronis and drank our great wine in the outdoor courtyard up in Chelsea. We hope to see you next year as well. We'll certainly let you know if there's any news on that. Thanks also to everyone who's been listening to the new fall season. We have a bunch of great new shows coming for you every Wednesday. We'll be releasing them Wednesday at 11 a.m. Live. Otherwise, you can always look at our website, heritageradionetwork.org/inthedrink, in order to find all of the past episodes. I also recently got back from Harvest in Loreto Aprutino Abruzzo for the Annona wines in 2016. Has proven to be a really great vintage. It was rainy near Harvest and everyone was very scared, but it pushed things back. We're about a week and a half later than last year, but the fruit came in super, super healthy. Picking the multiple Chano fruit and doing it by hand with the team was certainly a lot of hard work, and it was really humbling and gave me a great understanding for what it really means to do to make an artisanal product up close by hand, a ton of work. And so it's really exciting to work on that project. And more information on that, you can go to www.annonawine.com. I realize I don't have to say www anymore. My Alyssa always gives me a hard time about that. So just annonawine.com. And please check out more information on Annona. All right. I am really excited about today's show. We have a master of wine. Actually, France's only female master of wine, Isabelle Legeron, is here in the studio with us today. She's going to talk about her raw wine fair, which she is bringing to New York. It is an international natural wine fair in Berlin, in London, New York, maybe somewhere else that I don't know about. She's also the author of the great book, Natural Wine, that really explains what is a natural wine, what is it not, why you should be drinking them. She's also sometimes known as that crazy French woman, but I don't think she's that crazy. Welcome to In the Drink, Isabelle.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. That's great to be here, I have to say.
So you're here a few weeks ahead of time for the raw wine fair. It's November 6th and 7th. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. In about 4 weeks' time now. Ooh, it's all very scary. You know, we've been planning this for over a year, and now it's here, and you just think, oh God.
And this is the first one in New York.
Yeah. And this is our first, event. I really hope it will be a success, and we hope to be here every year.
And tell us about how you came up with this idea for the raw wine fair. You're really known as the master of wine who's really taken the flag for natural wines. I don't know of any other. I'm sure a lot of them also love to drink them, but I don't know anyone else who's really made that their super cause. So how did you get interested in the wines, and how did you start the fair?
So the fair was started in 2012 in London, and I created that for two reasons. The first one is we didn't really have an event in the UK that was bringing all the growers together, giving the sommelier, the public, an opportunity to, you know, meet those people, because for me that's the most important thing, is to actually spend time and ask questions, taste the wines, and give them a little bit of context. So that didn't exist, so I thought we really need to do something about that. And then the angle for the fair straight away for me was about transparency, because one of I think the difficulties we have in the wine industry is that we pour a product, we serve a product, we drink the wine, but actually a lot of people don't really know how the wine is made. And at Raw, we've committed to transparency, and if growers add you know, the only thing really they add will be a bit of sulfites. Then we disclose that information and we mention exactly the total levels in each cuvée. And we get analysis from everybody, and it's a big research work. But then the show we produce, you know, then is full of integrity, full of transparency. And, you know, and I think as a result, really professional.
I think it's great that you're doing that, and I completely agree. I find that when I tell our guests in the restaurant that, you know, wine can be made with over 200 additives, and the only one that it has to be listed is sulfites, where in small amounts, it's potentially maybe the least of the things that people need to worry about. And certainly in large amounts, it can be really bad. They're surprised. They think that wine is just a healthy product.
Yeah, I think that's, to be honest, it's probably our fault, you know, in the wine industry at large, because I think we've been very good at selling the dream of terroir, the dream that wine is just grape juice that kind of springs off the ground, is fermented and you know, put into a bottle. You know, all these beautiful labels selling, you know, that kind of the hand factor, where actually a lot of wine are produced, you know, using a lot of machinery and barely touching the human hand. So I think, you know, we really need to redress that. And I don't think there's anything wrong, you know, whichever way. I think it's our duty is to communicate exactly how the wine is made, so that people can choose, you know, what they buy at the end of the day. I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I imagine that someone who was studying for the Master Wine Exam, you had to taste wines from all throughout the world. At that time, were you as interested in natural wine, and was it hard for you to kind of maybe taste these more industrially produced wines?
Yeah, no, actually, luckily I wasn't, because otherwise it would have been probably impossible.
I can imagine,
for me to finish the MW, because, you know, we'd spend a lot of time in very sort of so-called prestigious, expensive places that are not the wines I would be drinking at all today. So luckily for me, it was a very gradual process. And it was also a realization that I came to wine as a second career. So, you know, I was brought up on a farm, but escaped the farming. My family have a vineyard, because I thought there's no way I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life, because I had to do it when I was little. So I escaped the vines, went to university, studied, and then ended up working in London in kind of the business world. And then I went back to wine because I realized actually I was really missing home and, you know, the farm environment. But when I studied, you know, like you, the WSET and then the MW, I realized that wine wasn't really, you know, that idea of the farm and people with their dirty hands doesn't really exist a lot in the wine world. And I became gradually quite detached and quite disappointed, actually, because, you know, a lot of the wines ended up tasting the same. And so gradually I was getting a bit more, I don't know, bored, I guess, you know, of scoring wines and writing tasting notes. But, you know, I was also discovering that there was this parallel universe, and I kept tasting wines. I kept meeting people that really spoke to me and really resonated with what, you know, what I love about wine, which is really the farming and the people. And so I, you know, as I was finishing my MW, I was really opening up to this world. And when I completed it, when I finally sort of, you know, did the dissertation and passed, then I just kind of put, you know, shut the door to a chapter of my life and opened something else, which a lot of people thought it was career suicide, because, you know, suddenly I was like France's first French female master of wine. I had a lot of good, very good job offers. And I was like, actually, no, you know, I just want to really do something else. And then I, you know, went on a different route.
Right. I'm sure you'd have the power to move thousands of cases of wine. I picture, you know, the opportunity to taste whatever you want at that time, the most expensive, fanciest wines in the world. And instead, you decided to focus on these tiny, like very small production, very handmade wines. Mm. You know, I was having a conversation with a natural wine producer who said to me that she felt strongly that there's a certain limit of vineyard space, that you can't farm beyond 30 hectares or 50 hectares and still make a true artisan natural wine. Does that also play into a factor? I was looking through some of the parameters, how you choose wines, and you know, I agree with all of them. I mean, doing everything by hand and growing the grapes yourself. But do you find that the size of the vineyard matters as well?
Yeah, I think you know, by and large, for me, the people who probably make the most profound highly individual, full of personality wines. You know, they, I would say they probably farm up to about 10, 12 hectares, maybe a capacity of about maybe 50, 60,000 bottles. And that already is probably actually quite a bit, you know, if you're going to be working completely naturally. So I think, of course, you know, it's not scalable unless you can afford to have loads of people working, you know, the land. But even then, I think the key thing for me into making natural wine is being able to farm, is being able to walk your vines, is being able to know each individual. Each of your vines are different. You know, they're a different thing. They have different needs, and to be able to work with those individuals, with those people in your vineyard, and then to be able to follow them through yourself all the way to the bottle. And I think, you know, that in itself will kind of limit how much, you know, wine you can make, for sure.
Yeah, if you walk your vineyard every day, then you know if that plant is actually looking great today or it's looking not so great today based on how it's been, you know, the rest of the year.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And, you know, I just wanted to mention something, because we keep on talking about natural wine. You know, Raw is not a natural wine fair, right? We are a fair that brings together natural wine producers, low-intervention organic and biodynamic wine producers. And for me, that's really important, because I think, for me, a natural wine is a wine which is made without adding anything. So 100% grape juice.
Not even sulfites.
Okay. Then we fall into the low intervention category where, you know, it's much better to use a little bit of sulfites than what is allowed under, well, organic in this country, you don't add any sulfites. But, for example, under Demeter, which is the biodynamic certification. So, of course, they are all very close to the idea of naturalness. But I think it's really important to, for me anyway, because I think at the moment, natural wine is becoming so, like, trendy, and everybody's talking about natural wine. But sometimes I see people call a natural wine something which is not even organically farmed, you know. And I think we really need to start getting organized and really call, you know, a cat, really.
Okay, so do you think that natural wine is also a style unto itself?
Yeah, I think that's a good description. I think people fall in love with the idea of natural wine. They fall in love with the story around natural wine, the romance of natural wine. But sometimes they just stop at that without digging down and actually finding out what constitutes a natural wine. You know, is this grower really producing all of his cuvées made from organic grapes? You know, it's, you know, in the wine industry, we're always looking for stories or hooks. You know, when you sell wine at a table, you want a hook. You want to be able to sell this $100 bottle of wine quickly. And I think there's a danger of oversimplifying things, you know, just because it's convenient.
Right. Oh, that makes sense. And so you have natural wine and then low intervention wine. And those, both of the two of those would fall under raw wine or in the raw wine fair.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's not that actually, if you look at how many people make completely natural wines in the world, there's not that very many. You know, there's, you know, maybe, I don't know, 150, 200, maybe a bit more, I don't know. But I've never actually really counted them, but there's not that very many. And I think it's also important to be inclusive. I think, you know, I've seen, you know, people who come to Raw really evolve as well. You know, I think when you bring people who work completely naturally and have a conviction, and then you bring people who maybe believe that sulfites is necessary to some extent, you put them together, there's a conversation. I've seen people who, you know, really reduce their levels of sulfites that they use over the years, because it's a journey we all have to learn. And I wanted Raw to be transparent so people can choose, but I wanted it to be also inclusive.
Okay, we're talking a lot about sulfites, and sulfites are the one additive that you allow. Why is it that you allow, that you think that sulfites are the one thing that can be added, and then you have a limit of, I believe, 70 parts per million of free sulfur in the bottle of total sulfur. How did you come to this limit?
I mean, sulfites is not the end of the story. It's just one measure. You know, they have to be organic. 90% of them are certified organic. There's no sterile filtration, you know, no yeast, no enzymes, no microoxygenation, no gadgetry. The only things people use sometimes are fining agents. 70 is a bit of an arbitrary number. You know, it doesn't relate to any certification out there. I felt it was quite a generous figure, because we applied for across the board, red, white, sparkling, sweet wines. So it's generous for red, but it's actually quite strict for sweet wines.
Right.
Right.
And just so everyone understands where why you're saying it's generous and across the board where that comes from, in the EU, the maximum amount of sulfites that are allowed to be added actually vary based on wine styles, dry red being the least amount you're allowed to add, with the idea that it's probably the most stable. There's no sugar to ferment. It has the anthocyanins, has the skins, which I can imagine have an antioxidant property. And then a sweet white being the least stable, which you can add the most because it does have sugar and it's not as stable. So you've decided to do across the board 70 parts.
And to give it some context, you know, when you look at EU laws, a red wine can have a maximum of 150 parts per million, mm-hmm. and a white wine 200 parts per million, and sweet wine is 350 or 400 depending on the style. And 70 is still a lot lower than what you would get out there. Even with Demeter, you know, I think Demeter is like 90 or something, depending on, you know, the countries. But we would like to lower this mm-hmm. over time. You know, I still feel 70 for a red is way too much. You know, I wouldn't drink that personally, because I think you can work, if you work well in the vineyard and you take your time to make the wine, you can actually make wines, you know, without adding anything. So over time, our aim is to lower, you know, this total figure.
All right. All right. On that note, we're going to take just a very quick break. We'll be back with Isabelle Legeron, master of wine and founder of Raw Wine Fair on In the Drink.
This is Butterscotch by Talkstar on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back in a minute with the second half of In the Drink.
Bordeaux is one of the most reputable and well-known wine regions in the world. While many are familiar with its legendary first growths, there is so much more to discover. Bordeaux offers a dynamic and diverse range of wines, different styles, different colors, and different price points. Did you know that Bordeaux produces crisp, refreshing whites? Or that many of its outstanding reds can be opened now and don't need years aging? Or that it's really easy to find a great bottle of Bordeaux for under $20? With such a diverse offering, Bordeaux wines can pair with a huge mix of contemporary foods and cuisines. Bordeaux wines, red, white, rosé, there's a wine for everyone. For more information, visit bordeaux.com/US.
All right, we are back with Isabelle Legeron, the founder of the Raw Wine Fair, coming to New York on November 6th and 7th, an international wine fair that brings together natural and low interventionist wines from around the world, some outstanding wines. You can find the list of the wineries on their website, and I will definitely be going. I'll be going on Monday the 7th, but I think on Sunday the 6th, there's still tickets available, if I'm
yes.
correct. So I recommend, highly recommend checking it out. On my trip to Abruzzo for a harvest, I ended up going over to Montalcino with my friend Chiara Pepe, who has been on this show a few years ago, actually. And she had mentioned she visits London quite frequently. And she actually credits you very much with being a true a catalyst for improving the wine scene in London. She said that she's noticed that since the Raw Wine Fair has been there, there are so many more interesting wines in London, and she thinks that it truly was a catalyst for improving the wine. And certainly you consult on many restaurants as well, and I'm sure it's a big part of it. In your time in New York, I wonder if you can give us a snapshot as to your impressions of natural wine in New York.
I think this is going to be a very limited outlook. You know, I've only been there a few times and been to a few places, but it seems to me that obviously the natural wine scene is burgeoning, or is it? You know, it's getting more and more popular. I see a lot of coverage. I see that people are. You know, there is a phenomenon in the US which is quite beautiful, which we don't get over in Europe, which is this kind of like, you know, sommeliers, wine buyers they're real public figures and they're real rock stars, and they have a lot of influence in the media. You don't get that over in the UK. You know, a lot about the chefs, but you never hear about the sommeliers. And actually, being here has made me think, how can we actually really pump up these guys who are doing such, and you know, guys collectively, you know, male and female, who are doing such an amazing job as you know, at curating wine lists. So that's given me a lot of food for thought. But I think I see that people are getting super enthusiastic about natural wine. And I think there is, you know, we need to sort of also make sure that all this enthusiasm is followed by knowing the wines properly, meeting the growers. And I think that's kind of what raw wine has helped do is really putting, you know, bringing all these growers together under one roof so you can chat to them, you can improve your knowledge, you know, create relationships. And then you're better at selling those wines because you have more of the background information. And also, obviously, you know, in London, we've created a demand for it because raw has grown massively. We've made a lot of noise. So I think the public is more and more aware and actually seeking out these wines. So it's that helps, in a way, fuel also a little bit, you know, the supply. It seems to me that, you know, there's a lot of room for growth is what I would say in New York in terms of there's still a few establishments where you can go and drink those wines, but maybe it seems like we could have.
It seems like most, more. In my opinion, it seems like most good places have some natural wine. Mm. Right? If you have a good wine list, you have to have some, at least some, but there are a few places where it's the whole list.
Yeah.
There's only a few.
Yeah, and that is the key because I think there is a difference between having a couple of wines on your by the glass pour, which is natural just as a draw, and actually being really, you know, like Pascaline, you know, Le Pelletier at Rouge Tomate, you know, because, you know, I'm very close friends with her and I had a really great look at her list and it's an inspiring wine list and you understand that from that list that she's curated, she really understands the growers. She has all the vintages. You know she's going to be aging some of that stuff. You know, that's a proper work. And we need more of that.
Yes, yes. And for those of you who haven't been yet, Rouge Tomate recently reopened, and you have to go. I haven't been yet. I'm sure it's going to be outstanding knowing Pascaline and the kind of work that she put into it. I've been speaking with her over the few years that she's been off. I think their wine training manual is about 200 pages, which blows my mind, and she is just the best. So when I think of these natural and low interventionist wines, the places that come to my mind tend to be mostly in France, right, in the Loire Valley, Beaujolais, Southwest France, all over France, and then Italy, because that's where I spend a lot of my time. What are some of the surprising places that we can find these wines? Where have you been excited about that? Maybe there's a little bit of a burgeoning of a movement for these wines.
I think, you know, well, Australia, you know, you're seeing more and more people, particularly sort of, you know, the group with Tom Shawbrook and, you know, in the Adelaide Hills, they've kind of spurred a really actually vibrant movement. And then they've created this Rootstock Festival. So there is something exciting happening over there. You know, obviously bits and pieces all around Europe. But I would say that for me, where I see a really great potential, which is just happening, but, you know, hopefully we'll see bottles coming out soon, is all these Central Eastern European countries, you know, that have had such, in a way, amazing heritage, you know, that very often has been crushed by the political system, by communism, where people lost the true art form of preserving these great varieties and making wines and sold out to, you know, bulk winemaking. But, you know, more and more I'm seeing people in Serbia, you know, obviously Hungary, Czech Republic, you know, where people are rediscovering their terroir. You know, it's taking time to rediscover your terroir. You know, same with Georgia. People are rediscovering their terroir. They're rediscovering the potential of these unique grape varieties, and they're learning to embrace them rather than plant Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay. So they're learning to embrace these grape varieties. They're moving towards, you know, more and more organics and traditional farming. Natural wine is going to be or whether it's natural or low intervention, is going to be coming the next step because for them, commercially, it's very tough to sell a wine which is slightly cloudy. In fact, in some places, you're not even allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think these countries, you know, the stuff I'm seeing in Slovakia, the things I'm tasting is really exciting. And I think for me, that's an area that I travel a lot to and I keep a very close eye on.
Yeah. How do you feel about cloudy wines in general? Do you not care at all? Does it pique your interest when you see a cloudy wine? Like when I see a cloudy cider, I'm like, oh, what's going on with that? That's probably really interesting.
Yeah. To me, to be honest, when I see a cloudy wine, it's you know, I know that already I don't have to wonder how the wine's been made in terms of, you know, the filtering and the fining. So I like, you know, a little bit of a haze, mm-hmm. you know, obviously, particularly in white wine. So, but it doesn't actually bother me, you know, either way, because I understand that if you keep your wine most of the time, you know, for long enough, it will settle down anyway. It's just when you tend to bottle maybe a bit too quickly, or if you have a year which is particularly rich in protein in the vineyard, then that's quite difficult to precipitate naturally over time. So, you know, if it's cloudy, great. If it's not cloudy, but it's still been made, you know, naturally with natural filtration, clarification, then great as well.
Yeah. So you don't have any detractors here at Heritage Radio, but how do you deal with the people? What do you say to the people who say that they don't like natural wine? Give me some like ammunition to talk to these people.
So I think the first thing is just to not really be judgmental. Right. So I think it's up to us to also be, you know, prepared that people like or don't like natural wine. And then for me, the way I look at natural wine is almost like I talk to people as if it was a food, you know, the wine has different expressions, different variations. And we're looking at a sector of wine, which is very similar to, you know, the sourdough bread versus the white bread experience, you know, the laughing cow cheese versus the, you know, the proper farmhouse cheese made from, you know, unpasteurized milk type thing. So I try to get people to relate to it as a new experience, getting them to sort of see that normally we taste with blinkers, that we're quite, you know, we taste inside a box, and it's important to kind of get rid of that box and embrace wine as if it was, as if they never had wine before, you know, because it might look different, it might taste slightly different, and be prepared for a different experience. And I think you need to, you know, some people, when, you know, if I work on the floor, or which is not very often, admittedly, but, you know, or do a tasting for consumers or, you know, members of the public, and I say, you know, are you prepared for something a bit different? And some people aren't. And then I think it's not even worth really challenging that. But otherwise, I think it's about looking at natural wine, looking at wine like a food and a new experience, as if we didn't know anything about wine, and rediscovering it.
Yes. And are there some events that you're doing around? Are there some like satellite events, some tastings that while you're in town that our listeners might be able to go to if they really want to get beyond just the experience of the raw wine fair?
Well, when the fair is going to be on, there are loads of grower tastings, grower dinners, you know, in places all around town. I mean, we will be publishing a list of all the offs that are happening. But if you're in New York that weekend, you know, the chance that you will, you know, spend an evening with a grower is really high. And for me, that's the most important, because when you go to a tasting, I mean, yes, you might spend 5-10 minutes with the grower and get to taste the wines and so on. But actually, you know, when you're hanging around with them and having a chat or having dinner, then it's very different. It is more intimate. So there'll be tons of stuff happening all around the fair, probably about a week leading up to the fair and afterwards.
And a few days after.
Yeah.
All right. And hopefully we can organize one of the growers to be a guest on the show as well.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Okay. We'll speak after and we'll figure out who would be a good guest. All right. Isabel Legeron, Master of Wine, author of Natural Wine. You should go out and get that book. And the founder of the Raw Wine Fair, coming to New York November 6th and 7th. I definitely recommend you check it out. I will be there. Thank you so much for being a guest on In the Drink.
Thank you for having me on the show.
All right. In the Drink is produced by David Tadashore, and Aaron Fairbanks runs the Heritage Radio Network. Special thanks to Heritage Foods for putting the Heritage Radio Network together. And we'll chat with you guys next week. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.